Whenever you're ready. Let's open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is March the 7th, and we've got two of our colleagues here, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2716 and ask Senator Mona Sanderson, Representative Gorsuch, and would you like to bring your constituent with you?
Welcome on up.
And Sharon Wellman?
Shauna.
Shauna.
Go ahead and start.
Okay, welcome.
You want to go second and have
whoever would like to start.
All righty. Well, good morning, committee. It's been a while since I was up there with you all. For the record, however, I'm State Representative Chris Gorsuch, House District 49, East Multnomah County, and I am here to introduce to you House Bill 2716, which is about whitewater rafting helmets. First, I want to start off by just talking a little bit about why we have a variety of helmet bills in the sporting arena. Obviously, beyond the concern we have for people's well-being, head and back injuries can be a very expensive proposition, certainly for the citizen. And if the citizen is unable to take care of all of the expenses, that might also be something then that's incurred by the state. We also, of course, are concerned about the human cost of not wearing a helmet or having that available. And certainly that is much greater than worrying about the cost when you think about what can happen. Robert Burge is a constituent of mine, and he and his daughter, Shauna, who's sitting next to me, approached us to work on a bill that would address some of the safety problems that led to the death of Robert's wife and Shauna's mother, Sharon. This was due to a head injury that was sustained on a whitewater rafting trip. She was a person who was always concerned about safety. In fact, she'd done a lot of safety work in her professional life, and she would have worn a helmet if it had been offered, and she certainly would have insisted on helmets for her grandchildren who were with her that day in the raft. After looking into industry standards and speaking with other rafting outfitters, it became apparent that offering helmets to adults and requiring them for children is already standard practices for many of these businesses. Most outfitters we've checked in with, talked to, or looked up on the internet share pictures of whitewater rafters. Each one shows, or most all these show, the folks wearing helmets. Clearly, helmets are important to the marketing of these companies. We talked with Eric, the managing partner at a place called Orange Torpedo in Josephine County. And he told my legislative director that helmets are available on all of their trips. So the investment in these helmets have certainly been made, at least by what we would consider most of the businesses. Val Schall, an outreach coordinator for a group called Team River Runner, a group that provides rafting opportunities for wounded veterans, emphasized the importance of helmets. And his quote is, "Rivers aren't rides at water parks. Mother Nature is unforgiving. Help can sometimes be hours away. Over my lengthy career, I've taken many headshots, and if it wasn't for the fact that I was wearing a helmet, I would be dead or in a care center." There are laws that require helmets for people of all ages for whitewater rafting across the country. Think of places like Colorado, Utah, Massachusetts, Maryland, and even the National Park Service. In Colorado, interestingly enough, they have a law requiring helmets for whitewater rafting, but not for bicycling. So we're the reverse of that. It's also important to note that in our discussions with the Marine Board, Director Scott Bruin looked into the outfitter that failed to offer this minimum standard for the Burges and found that they also neglected to report the death of their customer. So, in conclusion, having this modest standard requiring helmets be required for kids 12 and under and offered to adults that are customers of rafting guides and outfitters would not only protect families like the Burges, it would also provide an extra incentive that would ensure safety standards are followed by all of these organizations. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I suppose we can hear from the other folks, and then I'm here for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I'm delighted to be here. Again, I met Mrs. Burge's husband last summer, and he talked about this, and I felt the death of his wife, and then Shauna also, and so I felt very compelled to introduce legislation. As a public health nurse, I find it prevention is in healthcare, in whatever you do, we should always have prevention at the top of our agenda. So I love. I used to love river rafting. I did a lot of it with my kids when we were younger. It was a great thing to do with the family. And my daughter, we hit a rapid on the Deschutes River. She was thrown and hitting a big rock, and I panicked because I was in another raft, and she actually had just gotten trapped underneath. But still, there was a big rock. She was not wearing a helmet, and you can't imagine what a mother feels like when she can't find her daughter who was underneath the raft. So some outfitters did have helmets available, and others didn't. I didn't pay any attention to it, and I should have. So especially after you hear about Massachusetts helmet laws and Colorado helmet laws, Maryland's helmet laws, and then the National Park Service's rules in Colorado and Utah have helmet laws. So I hope you consider this. I think a testimony said you can get dehydrated with a helmet. I had not heard that. Being fair-skinned, I need to wear a hat all the time, whether it's on a beach or on a river, et cetera. So I was interested as to what the Marine Board did propose when I had my bill last week. So I would like to turn this over to Shauna, because she can relate to you the story that she had that brought this to both Representative Gorsuch and my attention.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, and the rest of the committee. My name is Shauna Wellman. My address is 14628 Southeast 130th Drive in Clackamas, Oregon, 97015. I represent my family, my father, my two kids, and myself. My family is here in support of House Bill 2716 in memory of my mother, Sharon Burge. On July 6, 2015, our family, including my two young boys, who were 8 and 6 at the time, took a commercial rafting trip down the Deschutes River in Maupin. My mom had purchased this rafting trip on Groupon as a fun family outing to do with her husband, her daughter, and her grandkids. You can still find this item selling on Groupon. It's a 3-hour trip designed to be an excellent introduction to river rafting. They state that the guides provide all the necessary supplies, including life jackets, oars, paddles, dry bags, frames, and ropes. Tragically for our family, there was one item that was missing from this excursion, and that was helmets. We were going through a Class 3 rapid when our raft had tipped sideways. My mom, Sharon, was forcefully thrown from one side of the raft to the other, and she hit her head on something inside the raft. Sharon suffered severe brain trauma from this incident and was taken to Mid-Columbia Medical Center in the Dalles via ambulance. She was quickly evaluated, and they found swelling and bleeding on the brain. She was categorized as a trauma patient and life-flighted to OHSU. She was in a coma during her entire hospitalization, and she died 10 days later. My mom was in the care of Dr. Tucker at OHSU during her hospitalization. Unfortunately, Dr. Tucker is not able to be here today, but she has provided a statement that I have attached to my testimony. Dr. Tucker felt strongly that if Sharon would have had a helmet on, it would have saved her life. Some of the information from her testimony that I think is really important to this is that most of us are focused on sports-induced TBI, has been football, ice hockey, and soccer. But there has been an increase in sports-related head injuries in water sports. 28,716 head injuries due to water sports were treated in U.S. emergency departments in 2009, and the number is growing. Helmets dissipate and distribute the energy a brain suffers from traumatic impact, providing an outward hard shell and an inner cushion to protect the brain from deformation as it crashes into the skull from outward impact. What we're trying to do today is avoid another family being in an emergency room and having a doctor say that if your family, loved one, would have been wearing a helmet, they'd be alive today. My mom was employed for 42 years at Boeing Portland. Her motto was always safety first. She was the head of the safety committee during most of her employment there. If helmets would have been provided, all five of us would have had them on. The cost of her injuries, aside from life, the financial impact of this trauma was over $300,000 in medical bills at OHSU alone. This does not include the cost of ambulance transport, CT scans, and care at Mid-Columbia Medical or the LifeLight from the Dalles to OHSU. With this money, we figure over 6,000 helmets could be provided. Helmets are required for all times when people are riding or kids are riding bikes and scooters for all kids under the age of 18. Zip line companies, horseback riding tours require helmets for participation year-round, regardless of the temperature outside. In many cases, helmets are not being offered as an option by commercial rafting companies in the state of Oregon. What we're asking is that all rafting companies have helmets available to all participants. Our family supports a requirement for youth to be wearing helmets when rafting waters that include Class 3 rapids or above. Regulating this, we suggested agencies would be the State Marine Board, the Oregon State Police, county sheriffs, who are already regulating life vests and other safety items on the rivers. We think if one helmet can prevent a fatality, then we have been successful. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify before you today on HB 2716 and also for your support in bringing this to their attention. Be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for this group? Vice Chair McLean.
I just want to make a comment. I really appreciate you being here today, and I know this has to be extremely difficult. And I think it's a good idea, and I think it's a common sense idea, and thank you for bringing it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And were you going to respond to?
I was going to just say that in the Senate bill, there was a question about when people would be wearing these. We would anticipate that the spirit of this bill would be that kids would always have them on, not wait until they were approaching a rapid and then putting them on. So as soon as they were in the rap, they would be wearing it.
Okay, Representative Brando.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm very sorry for your loss. But I was wondering how many accidents like this occur every year in Oregon? Do you know that?
I actually have that. But no, I would need to have my staff bring it. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. If you can get it to me, that would be
good. Thank you. Representative McKeown?
You might not be able to answer this. Thank you, Chair Clem. But I'm kind of curious, because I've been involved with folks who have had the same type of issue on skiing, snow skiing. Do we require helmets for kids on skiing? Have we imposed that on skiing facilities now? Do we know that? Does anybody know?
I don't know.
Head injuries occur often because people run into things when they're skiing.
Right, exactly.
I know there's been conversation about that type of recreational activity and the same type of exposure that you have. I just wondered if there's a precedent for this someplace else. I'll try and find it out. Thank you so much.
We can also check on that, too.
Just a couple of questions. Shauna, you mentioned Class 3. Mm-hmm. The bill says Class 2. Are you thinking Class 3 and we would need to amend if we do something?
I had always considered Class 3.
But myself, too. That might be an error.
Okay.
So we need to fix that. Go ahead, Shauna.
We were in a Class 3 rapid, so I think that's...
Yeah, I was looking up because I don't... I floated a lot, but nothing major, so I never learned the difference between 3, 4, and 5, so I was looking...
There's a big difference.
I think it's just Class 2 and Class 3, or Class 2 and higher.
Who are higher, but you're thinking 3 or higher.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on this other part, and this you may not know the answer to this, but we could find out, because this requirement on the 12-year-old or under is situated inside the guide statute, and it's tied together with above it the requirement that the guide ensure that it's got. Let's see. So it says, if the outfitter and guide is a charter guide, ensure the vessel used to carry passengers complies with equipment requirements, and on these types of rapids, require that all persons 12 or under. I'm wondering whether that only then limits the 12-year-old requirement to charter guide situations only. And is that your intent, or are you looking at to be whether they're on a charter trip or not, recreational or not, just on a river 12 and under or only with charter guides?
The that part of the bill, I believe, was done. By the way, is somebody from the Marine Board going to testify?
They're here and probably could take questions, okay, but so not planning to.
I would anticipate that the way we wrote it was for charter operations.
I just want to make sure we get your intent right.
Yeah. What do you think?
And we can talk offline, too, if you like.
Yeah.
As a public health nurse, I think it's common sense for anyone,
right,
whether they're rafting with a charter group or not. Safety should always come first.
And enforceability might be an issue, too. If you don't have it consistent across all things, then you're stopping boats to see whether there's a licensed charter guide when you see an 8-year-old with no helmet. You know, who's licensed and who isn't. It might be easier to have it be just one standard or the other all the way.
Yeah, so I think, Mr. Chair, that makes sense, and we could certainly adjust that, amend it, so that it would just say that. That way enforcement would probably, you're right, probably be clearer, more straightforward.
Okay, I think we've got the gist of it. Any other questions for this group? Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
You bet. Anybody else here on this bill? I've just got this group signed up on it. You are?
Right.
Uh-huh. You're welcome to come up. And just let us know your name before you get started so we have a record for the listening audience.
My name's Kara Spalding. I'm with Morrison's Rogue Wilderness Adventures. We run the Rogue River. And
I'm Erin Kennedy. I'm with Morrison's as well. And we're representing the Wild Rogue Outfitters Association.
Great.
So we just have a couple of key points that we'd like to go over with you coming from a rafting view. Sorry, I'm a little nervous.
we're tame. Don't worry about us.
And to the last speaker, we do want to say we're sorry for any loss that they had on.
Yeah, that is. So to answer on how many accidents that have been in relation that are related to having helmets, we have a little bit of research that we done. And in fact, in Oregon, the deaths related to water in 2015, none would have been prevented by wearing a helmet. According to the Ocean State Marine Board, in 2015, we had 16 people die in recreational boating accidents in Oregon. Our oldest victim was 81. Our youngest victim, sadly, was only 4. Only four of the 16 victims were wearing their life jackets. One of those 4 persons had a heart attack while water skiing. Another person's lanyard got tangled in a root wad. And a third person died of hypothermia. In these 3 instances, their life jackets were of no use. The 4th PFD wearer was the 4-year-old who drowned in extremely rough waters in a narrow gorge. Of the 16 fatalities, it is reasonable to assume that had the other 12 victims worn their life jackets, they may have survived their accidents. 6 of the 16 victims were in an open motor boat. 1 was on a PWC, personal watercraft. 6 were in non-motorized boats, 2 were on paddle boards, and 1 was on a log raft. 8 of the 16 victims were over the age of 50. In 11 of the 16 fatalities, the victim was the operator. In 6 of the 16 fatalities, the victim was the operator and sole occupant. So According to the Ocean State Marine Board, the number one cause of fatal accidents this year was alcohol, drugs, followed by a tie between hazardous waters and operator inexperience error. Total Oregon boating fatalities is less than 0.000009%. This proposed rule is disproportionate to the actual impacts that are reported regarding fatality and boater negligence related to the helmet use on public waterways. This law places an unneeded additional restriction on outdoor recreation that will result in increased costs for river users and could impact the Oregon tourism industry.
Do you want to read the rest of this part down? Helmets do not protect from the sun or offer the water retention and cooling properties which hats can offer. One of our primary medical concerns on summer trips is dehydration and overheating. Helmets can actually
exacerbate.
Thank you. Yes. These problems increasing health risks to clients. Unnecessarily safety equipment has been known to ultimately have negative health consequences through inspiring undue confidence in the wearer, causing them to take on dangers they may have previously avoided, sometimes described as safety saturation. This law is arguably unenforceable. No other state has a law like this. As the Oregon State Marine Board would likely testify, ambiguous language such as sections of water rated class 2 or higher does not clearly describe when or where people are supposed to wear helmets. Oregon's current PFD law uses similarly ambiguous language, which has led to incredibly low enforcement rates. This rule places an unnecessary burden on outfitters that cater to those wanting to enjoy our public waterways, disregards industry experience or expertise surrounding on the water safety measures and equipment use, and does not have any substantial data. Requiring helmets exclusively on commercial trips is placing a requirement on the community where the fewest number of injuries occur and where the industry already has standard best practices regarding helmet use. Moreover, the commercial industries represent a minority of overall river users in Oregon.
So for us, I don't know, I've been a raft guide for 11 years now, and just taken to the effect of taking anyone down, just getting them to wear their PFD, which is considered the most safe thing on the water, is a personal flotation device. Tailing a 12-year-old or 11-year-old on, let's just say we run a 4-day wilderness trip, to have them keep their personal flotation device on is hard enough to be like, here's a helmet, wear it in the flat water. And that is what we're trying to say. And I agree with anyone wearing helmets class 4, class 5. I agree that that should be an option. I also agree that, you know, helmets should be made available if requested. But I don't agree with the fact that we need to have helmets and are placing a law for class 2, class 3. And
I'll let them start. Representative McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'm struggling with this mightily. I've gone down the wild section countless times in inflatables, in drift boats. I've hiked the trail. I've been down there many, many times. I'm very familiar with what you do. And I understand what you say when you get to that flat water and everybody wants to be jumping off the boat and they're jumping off the rocks and everybody's having a good time. I also understand the danger when you're going through Blossom Bar, you're going through, you know, a myriad of class threes when you have novices. And I know you are all very well trained and you do a wonderful job of protecting your clients. It's what you do and you do it well. But I also understand the risk that we're dealing with here, that this question has been raised. And I guess what I'm struggling with is, you know, there's some parental responsibility here as well. When I brought my kids down many, many times in inflatables, nobody wore a helmet. If I was going to do it today with a grandchild, I'd be putting a helmet on them because I know more. And I think part of this is education, and we haven't talked about that piece of this, is how do we educate the public in how to best protect themselves. I brought up skiing because 10, 15 years ago, nobody wore a helmet on the mountain. We skied for 35 years, and nobody wore a helmet. Now people wear helmets. They put helmets on their kids when they're in Mountain Masters because they don't want them hitting a tree and having something terrible happen. So, you know, the awareness is increasing over time as to why we need to protect our heads. Kids wear helmets on bicycles. I'm not quite sure where the line is here between imposing something upon you as a guiding, as an outfitter, that at first blush makes a lot of sense. But in practicality, I know what you're saying. You're not going to keep a helmet on a kid when you're going down the slick. I mean, you're just not going to. So I'm not sure where the practical nature of this is. But I also understand that there is a risk. And if we can mitigate that risk, we probably should in some regard. Now, if you're offering helmets to your clients, if they want to wear them, if you have them, if you have a parent coming with children, do you have helmets available for them?
Oh, yes, definitely. We bring helmets with us regardless, especially because we require them as a company to have them on an inflatable kayak. Yeah. So instead of just having them on a raft, we provide...
You're clipping them to the kayak. You've got something there if you want it.
Yeah, we have helmets on trips. And people can wear them whenever they want. They're available to them.
And that's every outfitter. That's not just like our particular company or something like that. That's all the outfitters have that requirement and stand by that.
I guess the next question becomes, how far do you go with something like this? So if we require outfitters, do we then impose a regulation that says if you're a parent with a kid in a raft and you're going down the Deschutes or coming down the Rogue, do they have to put a helmet on their kid? I mean, where does this start and where does it stop and what's practical? But also, how do we get to the problem? Because we want to protect people's heads. So I'm just throwing all this out because I think this is a very difficult subject.
Is it an age thing? Like, is it something where we have to go so strict as to say you can't be out there unless you're 12 or older? I mean, is that where we need to go just based on those kind of things? I mean,
I'm sure we're not going that far.
we had our kids going down your stretch when they were little.
Yeah. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, on the Rogue, are they Class 3? Is that the biggest you have, and does that depend on time of year?
It changes. So, I mean, it changes on water level, obviously. It could be really high water, really low water, and that will change the class of the rapid. Or, in some cases, it'll take out the entire rapid, and it'll just be nice and flat. And yeah, that would be another thing that you'd have to look into is what do you consider a Class 3? What do you consider a Class 4? And really, I mean, I think our company and most of the companies on the river, we all call Blossom a Class 4 because it is a Class 3 rapid, but a Class 5 consequence. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it makes it higher. Mm. So it's really determining, you know, some of the rapids that I used to work out in Colorado, what I would consider a Class 2 out here on the Rogue would be considered, or a Class 3 out here on the Rogue would be considered Class 2 out in Colorado. So it's really, if it's going to be, we'd really have to figure out what kind of class you guys are, what we're dealing with. And then there's just not a lot of data saying that, hey, there's been head injuries for rafting and we need to enforce helmets. There's just not enough support, I feel like, to have that there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, is there, if we were to change the class at which the bill specifies helmets, would that make a difference to you, either of you?
I would say Class 4. I believe in Class 4.
Probably, yeah. Because Rainy Falls, nobody goes down because that's they make all of the
rafters
have to get up and hike. Mm-hmm. And that would be considered a 5. So as far as a 4, I mean, I would definitely say that they could, you know, bring them with them. And then as they're, you know, going over that stretch of it, you know, that's not a whole day's worth of trying to make sure that a 6 or 8-year-old is keeping a helmet on for an entire day.
Follow up.
So it's not an issue then of helmet or not. It's more an issue to you of the class of rapids that we would be specifying the requirement for.
I would say that's
yes.
about right.
Yes.
Does your guide service guide for mountain biking as well?
No.
Do either of you ride mountain bikes?
A little bit. Dabble.
The reason I ask
is because of the helmet.
Typically, when children ride bicycles, even on the flat, it's a good idea for them to wear helmets. They may fall off, they may hit their head, and I think that's what we're trying to get to here. So I'm really glad that it's not an issue of helmet or not, but at what level do we require those helmets? So I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also interpreting that it's a matter of responsibility of parental guidance is kind of what you're saying in another way, that it's not only the rapids, but it's also give them the opportunity to have that option. But you, what you're saying, you don't want to be responsible for these kids. When the parents are there, they should be supervising their own children. Is that what you're leading up to?
We're not babysitters, if that's what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah, that's another question, actually. I'm not sure who the penalty would be against in this case, if it would be the guide or the 12-year-old. I'm thinking it's probably the guide, because it's in the guide section of the law. But,
yeah.
Okay, well, we've got some more questions we may ramp up. Oh, Vice Chair McLean.
One of the things that you mentioned was the fact that, you know, it depends on the day, it depends on, you know, the rapid, you know, as far as what's happening with it. And, you know, I mean, when I was a child, we rode in the back of pickup trucks, right? We didn't ride with helmets on and everything else. That wasn't necessarily a good idea. It's just where we were in the culture of safety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like one of the other folks was saying that, you know, you don't think you need the helmet, or you don't think you need the extra, you know, vest or whatever it is until there's a problem. And then everybody, you know, wants to have one on. So to me, it's not the water, but maybe it's more education, like Representative McEwen was talking about. And my question is, do you say to them, you know, whoever's coming into your boat, we have helmets, it might be a good idea, there's going to be some pretty heavy rapids today. You've got smaller children here, but what kind of education is going on? Because a lot of people that walk into your boats aren't like Representative McEwen, and they've never been in one before.
So to answer that, there is an extensive orientation we go through the day before. That would be all outfitters. They go through each, the process of what can happen, what are the dangers. All of that is gone through in a safety speech, which is where all the training comes from. And that, they're known the day before it's told to them, in extensive 45 minutes, sometimes an hour talk, and then before they actually go out on there. And then as they're going and coming up, when you're rafting on the different, whether it's Mule Creek or, you know, Blossom Bar or Rainy Falls, they stop, they go over it again, and they say, this is where we're headed, these are the dangers, this is what you need to do. And so it's like if the boat goes over, you need to be on your back, have your legs up, and you need to just float to the next, you know, area. Those are things that we go over on a regular basis with our guests. You know, I'm not sure how much more we can convey. Yes, are the helmets available? Yes, we have them on the actual rafts themselves. I mean, we're definitely giving every last thing but a piece of paper necessarily that says it to them, but we also hand that out to them before they sign off on that stuff, before they go on the trips. They have their itineraries. They have their special needs, if it's dietary or whatever. So all these things are signed off on. So, I mean, I don't know how much more or how many more steps we can take before whose responsibility is it at that point.
And then, yeah, also on that, just like getting them all geared up. Some people feel invincible when you give them a PFD that's really padded, protecting all those vital organs, then just throw a helmet on top of it. And imagine, like, some little kid that's not, that usually is really safe around rocks, is now darting up the side of the hill, jumping all over the place because they think they're invincible, you know? They have all these it's just like a false illusion in some instances.
Okay. Thanks for coming up and testifying. And that's my list for this bill. And we've got some other bills to get to. So okay. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2716. And I think both of our legislators are gone. But thank Shauna for coming. And we will have some further conversation about this bill.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to switch the order on the agenda real quick just because Representative Barnhart has entered the room, and we'll get him testified and on his way. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2853. Ask Representative Barnhart to join us. Do you want to bring Chris with you? Okay. Welcome to the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and I'm very pleased that you scheduled this hearing this morning. What this bill does, and it looks like I don't actually have a copy of it, what this bill does is establishes a cap on the manure tax credit based on the current usage of the tax credit. Because of the relating clause, there's a number of different things the committee might do. But let me tell you what the problem is, and then leave it in your hands. As everyone in the committee knows, we face a huge shortfall in revenue for this biennium. One of the responsibilities of the Revenue Committee and the Joint Committee on Tax Credits will be to figure out what part, if any, the existing tax credits will play in helping to reduce the amount of our general shortfall. So when we look at this kind of a bill, what we're trying to do is to see, is essentially to get your committee's advice on what we ought to do in this area, and keeping in mind the general problem that we have. This tax credit currently costs about $4 million a year. It has expanded greatly since 2012 because different operations came online during that time. And what it essentially pays for, as I understand it, and Chris can correct me, is transportation to move materials. I'll let you come up with the other language for that. to the biodigesters, so that the methane and other volatile gases can be extracted and burned to be used to generate electricity, rather than going into the atmosphere. It's part of our long-term project to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants into the atmosphere from the kind of operations which can be highly polluting if we're not careful, the concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. So I am not wedded to the specific proposal in this bill, but I am interested in hearing. I think the Revenue Committee and the Joint Committee on Tax Credits is very interested in hearing your advice on this tax credit and maybe any others that we send to you. I don't think there are any others at this point. And to understand what the effect it would be on limiting the tax credit, what the effect on the economics of this area would be, and then in more general ways, what kind of economic development does this tax credit promote, if any? How many jobs does these operations produce? And part of the impetus for that, for raising it this time, is that we understand that there is a proposed large new CAFO that may come online later. Which will have the effect of significantly bumping up the amount of this credit, since there is currently no cap on the credit. So there's a couple of things you could do. You could pass the bill as it is, send it on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. You could amend the bill to put a cap on the amount of the credit. You could do nothing, which frankly would be not very helpful to us. Or you could simply write us a report telling us what you find and what your recommendations are in the general area. I would think it would be extremely helpful to us because we're looking at a dozen, maybe a few more tax credits. This is being only one of them. And altogether, handling these things correctly could reduce our deficit in the neighborhood of, tens of millions of dollars. I don't know the exact number at this point. Or not. And a lot of it depends on the specifics of how these things work. So I'm very pleased that the bill is here. I'm very pleased that it's in your committee's capable hands to help us figure this out. And Chris Allenack is here in case you have technical questions.
Chris, you're just a question guy.
I believe that's
okay. All right. Yeah. Questions for Representative? Yes.
I'm sorry, just basic questions. Thank you, Chair Clem. So how long has this tax credit been in effect, and how many operations are taking advantage of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative McEwen, for the record, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office. It's been in effect since 2007. At the time, it was administered by the Department of Revenue, and so we have kind of a blank period of detailed information from 07, 09. In 2010, it got transferred to the Department of Energy. And in 2015, there were 59 credits allocated.
Quite a few.
And there could be, to clarify that a little bit more, there could be more than one credit per entity. The credit is a certain amount per amount of material, and it depends on the trips.
By the ton or the yard or the?
The ton.
Ton.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 59 credits, did you say in 2015?
Correct.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So is this for just installations, or is this for ongoing maintenance, or how does that work?
Well, the Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, the credit is a function of the wet tons of the material.
Okay.
So in a sense, it pays for the transportation of the material, but it is calculated on the amount of material.
All right, thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Do we require that the person not be able to actually process on site? So it has to be moved off of site. We're requiring, does the state require it to be moved off site to be processed?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, I don't believe there's any such requirement. It's just the amount of material that gets used that would otherwise not be used for these purposes. I'm not entirely certain that it's required to be moved because some of the credits can be used on farm.
Okay.
So that would suggest to me that it doesn't need to be moved.
Okay.
If I could add to that, the two big ones, as I understand it, are one is a very large unitary operation near the Columbia River.
3 Mile Canyon.
That processes its own effluent, as it were. The other large one is the Tillamook Co-op that manages this process for a lot of co-op members who are smaller, who are not going to ever build their own biodigesters because they're not big enough to do that. And so those would, I suspect, would be transported, some of them some distance, in order to get to the biodigester. There, as Chris pointed out, there are a bunch of others, but they're smaller.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize if you covered this while I stepped out of the room. But as a matter of public policy, if we think that biodigesters are good early on, why would they not be good after a certain date?
Thank you. That's a great question. I don't think the issue is whether biodigesters are good or not good. I think the question is how do we encourage their use? One of the reasons I included in your materials for today the Dairy Air Report from 2008 was because they talked about in that report about the processes that ought to be dealt with for dealing with dairy issues, air and water pollution, and the things of that sort. There are several ways you could encourage biodigesters. One way you can do it is the way we're doing it, with a tax credit, which costs the taxpayers and, of course, schools and other things we spend general fund money on. Or the other way to do it would be to require that large CAFOs deal with their air and water pollution themselves, and that just become part of their overhead. So I don't think the question is whether we should have biodigesters. My understanding is they're working pretty well. The question is, how should it be paid for, and should it be part of the essentially part of the general fund through a tax credit?
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so that goes really to the heart of the issue. And I wasn't talking about the biodigesters themselves so much, or I didn't intend to, as much as the public policy that right. surrounds it. And so, Mr. Chairman, as the revenue chair, does this beg the question of public policy here on this whole issue?
Chair Klein, Representative Witt, you know, we have a process in the legislature which is somewhat convoluted because the revenue process affects the general fund in a number of ways.
Yes.
Obviously, if you raise taxes, you increase the general fund, but if you pass a tax credit, you reduce it. That isn't within the purview, generally speaking, of the Ways and Means Committee. So our problem, our effort, is to try to figure out the best we can how to balance the public policy issues between spending revenue through the Ways and Means process and spending revenue through the tax credit process.
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm being responsive, but that's our difficulty. And when we come to an issue like this, it's partly political. It's partly policy, it's partly technical, and it's really the technical part that we were hoping to get some help from this committee to figure out. The one thing I know is that if we don't do anything, this credit is going to increase significantly in the next couple of years, unless the large CAFO that's being planned isn't actually constructed. Hence the language in the bill. But as I said, I think while you were out of the room, I'm not particularly wedded to the language in this bill, but I am very interested in figuring out whether we ought to cap the amount of the credit, whether we ought to be moving on to some other process to be managing this issue, whether it's finally time to start establishing a more significant regulatory system that would take care of those things by the business. I mean, and this committee's advice on that kind of question, I think, is critical because this is what you work on all the time.
So, Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
So, the issue is more one of runaway tax credits, not unlike what happened with Betsy, as opposed to the public policy that surrounds the encouragement of biodigesters.
Chair Clement, Representative Witt, you have tapped into my paranoia perfectly.
Thank you.
Because I'll tell you, that was a horrendous situation. This one is much smaller than that one was.
Yes.
And therefore, I think probably more manageable.
Thank you very much.
Representative Power.
I wanted to just confirm a couple numbers that I was reading in the research report with you. It looks like the most recent data we have, it's about a $6 million tax credit in total a year for the state?
Chair Clem, Representative Power, that sounds about right.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about these recommendations that came out of the Joint Committee on Department of Energy Oversight, specifically about moving the credit to the Department of Agriculture and establishing a program cap?
Sure. Chair Clem. Representative Power. I think part of that, for the Department of Energy, they have a number of tax credits, and they went through a process of whether or not they should be handling any of these tax credits. And so on this particular credit, it comes down to an issue of the policy purpose, which ties into some of the recent questions about why the credit would exist. So in part of that report, you have the policy purpose for the credit. So whatever input can be provided and whatever is determined about the purpose of the credit, that would ideally dictate which administrative which executive branch agency would have ownership of the track schedule, for example. When these were put in place, part of the argument for them was that this material could be used to generate and produce energy. So that suggests the Department of Energy. If the purpose of the tax credit is some other means, then energy may not be the appropriate agency because they deal with energy. The subject matter they know is energy. And so if you're dealing with environmental issues or other on-farm issues, I think that would suggest possibly the Department of Agriculture. It's just a way of stepping back, which is really what the whole process is supposed to be about, checking in on the tax credits, have the policy committees step back and evaluate, okay, what is the policy, why do we have this credit, and then let that determine the next step. It's kind of one step at a time. So whatever the policy is, and policy can be changed, and then clarified, and then if the policy purpose is changed, then what are the parameters of the tax credits that should be going forward, and then which executive branch agency should be in charge of administrating them? Is that...
Mm-hmm. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I think Representative Witt brought something up that sparked something in me. If we talk about the policy around what we have been doing for quite some time, and that has to do with the work that the Energy Trust does in incentivizing renewable power generation and investing in these operations so that we can capture that methane and produce renewable power. So our ratepayers are already investing in setting up these operations, which then puts us in a position to help transfer this material so that they can generate renewable energy at a reasonable cost. So if you look at the policy around it, it's a little bit more complex than just what we're doing with the tax credit, because there's a ramp up to it at the very beginning with the investment that our ratepayers are making in renewable power. So it just to add a little twist here.
Okay.
If I could, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair,
yes.
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, I think that's exactly right. These areas get very complicated very fast, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons why we set up the process in 2011, I think, maybe it was in 2009, of having policy committees review these tax credit ideas first. Chris has put together with the agreement of the Revenue Committee and the Joint Tax Credit Committee, a set of criteria for committees to review, which I think is in OLIS for this bill today. But it would be extremely valuable, if it's not on that list, to add the point you made. What are the various ways in which we subsidize these kinds of programs, and which ones make sense, given what our long-term goals are? Mm-hmm. And of course, goals is pretty complicated very quickly.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I was just reading. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reading through this Northwest Strategies, and they, in the end, they said they're willing to sit down at the table and discuss, you know, ongoing tax credits, not to eliminate the whole thing and just stop carte blanche, but to adjust them to where it makes sense for revenue and for them to use this technology, you know, to produce energy and the benefit that it does. So when there's a cost benefit like that, have you sat down with, I mean, I think Three Mile Canyon Farms is a pretty big producer in mm-hmm. this arena, and have you had that discussion with them as far as not just stopping the tax credit but adjusting it?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, I've met with Three Mile Canyon many times talking about these issues. This bill, of course, does not stop the tax credit. It simply limits it to the people who are currently receiving it. I agree. I'm not sure you made this point, but I would agree with the point that simply cutting it off does not make sense. Expanding it, however, is an entirely different question. And there are various methods we could use, including the one proposed in the bill, to avoid that.
Vice Chair McLean.
You had an interesting point there at the beginning, talking about the fact that there are some of these dairies that are never going to be able to build their own. And so there's always going to have to be some transport, and there's always going to have to be sharing of the facility. And we're always talking about helping small, you know, businesses. And so when you're saying that the bill only will let the 59 folks that have used it before have it in the future if we keep it, is that taking into consideration where the facilities are and where the front loading of the cost needs to be? Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you want us to analyze that, then we need to know that, because we need to know if it's going to be able to provide for the future of this business area, and also the future for a variety of sizes of businesses within that business area.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I think those are excellent questions for the committee to explore. I think an additional question for the committee to explore is the extent to which we want to use tax credits to encourage the development of CAFOs in Oregon. They have a number of problems associated with them that need to be carefully managed in order to avoid air and water pollution and ground pollution. Mm-hmm. And that's an area of expertise that peculiarly resides with this committee, mm-hmm. and not the Revenue Committee. I think you've asked great questions, but I'm not the one to answer them.
Okay.
The question I've got is, we've discussed this being really about new entities using it, but wouldn't it also be the same entities if they got another digester, because it's not tied, from the way I'm reading it, to the company or the taxpayer, but it's tied to a manure digester not in operation prior to January 1, meaning if you've got a new one, even though you already have one, your new one would not be, your old one would be eligible for the tax
Thank
code.
You, Chair Clem. Yes, that's one of the issues that I'm hoping this committee will consider. Okay.
Yeah. But the intent is no new ones. Existing ones, not existing people and farms keep getting to get new ones. It's potentially stop with the ones we've already subsidized.
Chair Clem, speaking, I think, for the Revenue Committee, I don't think that we have as specific an understanding of the issue as that. Yeah. I think what the point of this bill is to raise the issue and ask you to struggle with those questions.
Well, let's get on to struggling. We've got some people ready to weigh in on that. Okay, thanks for coming, and
thank
we really
you,
appreciate
Chair.
Your explanation of the concept. Okay, let me get, let's see if I can categorize these into for and against. Okay, Len Bergstein, why don't you come up, because you're first on the list. Tyler Alexander, are you for or against the bill?
Against.
Okay, why don't you come up? And Tammy, you're signed up as four. Is that on purpose? Then you can go ahead and come up, too. And we'll have our against panel after, or for the panel after that. Len, you're first. Tyler, second. Tammy, third.
Chair Clem, good morning, and members of the committee. My name is Len Bergstein, and I'm pleased to appear before this committee to present testimony on behalf of my client, Three Mile Canyon Farms. We oppose House Bill 2853 in its current form for the reasons that we've outlined in material, and I'd like to just go over some of that. Some of you may be new to Three Mile Canyon Farms, so let me just take a minute to describe us. Our farm is located 150 miles east of Portland, and it's near Boardman, Oregon, on 93,000 acres that were originally intended to be a space-age industrial park. Each day, we work hard to demonstrate that sound business practices and sound environmental practices can go hand in hand. And for us, that means being a responsible employer as well. We produce several hundred full-time jobs, a $12 million payroll, and we offer benefits and promotion opportunities to a culturally diverse workforce in proud partnership with our employee-chosen union, the United Farm Workers. We can talk about the kinds of benefits as we get into it, Chair Barnhart raised some important issues, and I'd love to talk about that if you're interested in, rather than reading through all of the things that we do and all the ways in which we add to the supply chain and provide economic benefits. I also would call to your attention the wonderful testimony by Daryl Moss on Farm Power Tillamook, and where he outlines his own investment of $9 million into the state and the yield of $15 million in benefits and a chart that he's put in your testimony that's in all this. So we began about 18 years ago, and since we began, we've operated a sustainable model. I won't go through all of the bullets, but I think it's important for you to know that we take this very seriously in terms of our environmental obligations. We have a closed-loop system, which for us means we avoid all of the waste that we possibly can on our farm. Our cows produce high-quality milk for Oregon's iconic cheesemakers and a growing industry of artisan cheese entrepreneurs. We think water is precious in our part of the state, and we use precision center pivot irrigation system monitored and managed by a very substantial investment in state-of-the-art wireless computer network to control water use on our crops. Water used to flush our dairies is contained and reused in a zero-discharge waste management system, highly regulated, and we love what we do with that. We use advanced technology to provide traceability on all our crops and cattle to assure the quality our customers and the general public expects. We voluntarily placed 23,000 acres into a wildlife conservation preserve to protect threatened and endangered species and Columbia Basin grasslands. It's managed by the Nature Conservancy, and we pay them for that management. And we voluntarily surrendered nearly a third of our water rights 18 years ago in order to protect flows in nearby rivers and streams. To help Oregon become a leader in reducing reliance on fossil fuels, we've partnered to create innovative renewable energy projects such as wind turbines and the methane digester, and we're planning to put in a solar array. We're not alone in that. A lot of people that in the dairy industry do that, and they do that as a function of a variety of things, including best management practices. I'm sure that Tammy will talk about that later, but we are proud to be part of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Group, where our fellow dairy folks spend a great deal of time trying to bring in best management practices on a rapid cycle, an innovation cycle that, quite frankly, is faster than a regulatory cycle, and it really gets results into the on the ground in practice much quicker than a cumbersome and costly regulatory system. We can talk about that if you want. So manure from our dairy, which is the subject of this subject this morning, provides a low cost source of nutrient-rich fertilizer and compost. It reduces our reliance on chemical crop protectants, and it increases the water retention of our properties of our soil, and drives the accelerated production of certified organic vegetables and grains to approximately 8,000 acres of production now. We're one of the largest organic farmers in our region. As you may know from the robust debates of the past three sessions and the comments of the chair from the Revenue Committee, our manure digester is central to our success as a closed-loop system. You and your colleagues have consistently supported this manure tax credit. And last session, we joined you in a shared sacrifice approach. We trimmed the subsidy from $5 to $3.50 a wet ton in exchange for extending the predictable benefits until 2021. We saved Oregonians $2 million in that process and opened it up for the Revenue Committee to be able to get the film and video tax credits moving in the direction that they wanted to, so we could enjoy Grimm for one more season, I suppose. If you look at Daryl Moss's testimony, you can see the reasons that we have made that compromise and that kind of agreement, and we think it's good for Oregon. That's the reason we're testifying in opposition to House Bill 2853 in its current form for many of the same reasons you've heard from others. Now, just you've heard from industry folks, you've heard from community leaders and their elected officials and others. What joins this broad base of diverse voices is a common concern that House Bill 2853 is a drastic reversal of a successful policy that's created numerous tangible environmental and economic benefits to Oregon's rural communities and the state as a whole. Today's manure digesters are the result of a progressive, targeted tax policy envisioned in the 2008 Oregon Dairy Air Quality Task Force that encouraged manure digesters as one of the smartest, voluntary, best management practices available to address state air quality. If somebody's interested in talking about this Dairy Air Task Force, we can talk about it a lot, either today or sometime future. It's one of the best and least understood studies that was done. There was a series of best management practices that were outlined by consensus. One of the most significant ones was the manure digester, which some people who were part of that compromise have done everything they can to try and undermine and destroy. But in fact, that was the compromise that sealed the deal. And in fact, a series of other kinds of best management practices were listed. And as I think that Tammy will share with you in her testimony, you'll see that that dairies have kept their faith with you and that they've actually done this best management practices voluntarily. In a way that kind of cycles in those benefits quicker, and in fact, without a regulatory system that you all know, it gets costly and, in effect, puts a tax on everybody. A huge, costly regulatory system, in effect, creates a tax, a virtual regulatory tax, on every glass of milk, every cup of ice cream, every scoop of cheese that you take in the state. So that's the reason that we've decided to go in a different direction, I think, in Oregon, that you've done wisely since 2008, that every governor since 2008 has looked at those reports and said, you know what, in light of what we can accomplish, in light of what the problem really is, and you'll hear talk about the science in this area if you want at subsequent meetings, we believe that it's not a funded priority for the state at this point. We'd rather continue down the path that we're going, and it makes sense. So that's the reason that some of those things of the Dairy Air Task Force haven't been implemented. It's a intentional public policy decision based on a cost benefit analysis. I'll skip to some of these comments. I've listed in the rest of my testimony some of the negative things that happen if you do 2853 the way it was proposed. I think you'll undermine the thoughtful investment strategy that you've established. It wrongly labels digesters as a failed priority when, in fact, they are not. They're very successful for all the reasons we can talk about. They're not part of the problem. They're part of the solution, very clearly. And it would unwittingly play into the deceitful anti-dairy agenda of a small, intense interest group who are pushing various measures this session to repeal modest program support for Oregon's rural communities and replace it with costly regulatory burdens that smother the modest successes that have been achieved by Oregon's leading dairy operations of all sizes. Now, there's a subsequent referral, and the chair of revenue, who is an enormously smart and well-respected person, certainly I respect him, has said they'd like your advice. I think he's asking for some policy advice, and we've also kind of given you some policy comments and some tax policy comments that we would share with you or expand at another meeting. The current policy to promote manure digesters delivers important environmental and economic benefits for Oregon and our rural community. That's a policy. I think it's indisputable. And we've listed some of those things here: ecological benefits, greenhouse gas, energy benefits, economic benefits. As I said, Daryl Moss invested $9 million, and the state's yielded $15 million. We have a $200 million business that, if you use normal multipliers, that's a $600 million impact on the state. We help iconic brands deliver on what they need. Our milk goes to Tillamook, and a new factory was established at the Port of Morrow. It's indisputable about what the return has been to this, and maybe it makes sense to revisit the underlying policy, but it's indisputable. The public policy benefits of this are indisputable. Eliminating the manure tax credit for future digesters, as I understand the reading of this from your staff, will be a disincentive for the expansion of dairy industry to meet innovative future product demands. There is an emerging market for whey products, and we tap that a little bit at Three Mile. There's a bunch of different new ways in which milk products can be used. And if you stop the incentives, they'll stifle those rural communities that would welcome the boost to their local economies and jobs from a profitable, environmentally sustainable, medium-sized dairy operation consisting of a dairy herd and a digester. It seems to me like we ought to be doing this, and we think it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't have to be as big as our operation, but it can be a very successful. A dairy herd and a digester makes a good economic strategy for some communities. Modernizing and right-sizing the manure digester credit is a desirable alternative to repeal and elimination of a program that's helped Oregon achieve important multiple public policies. So a defined cap, for example, one idea of limited duration, and a tapering tax subsidy going from 350 down to zero over the course of the subsidy makes sense as a policy. Eliminating doesn't seem to me to make much sense. Certainly, reasonable people can differ. But you can you're not kind of stuck with ending the manure tax credit and kind of keeping it the way it is. As the chairman said before, we can have a smart, redefined, modernized, right-sized policy that makes really good sense. We'd recommend that this committee really kind of like amend 2853 in a significant way to reflect your strong support for the manure tax credit as a policy issue, that you would be supporting the dairy industry and rural community economic development while providing guidance to the Revenue Committee that reviewing and right-sizing the credit is the smartest and most progressive path forward. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks. Tyler.
All right. Well, Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Tyler Alexander, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. By way of background, OFB is the state's largest general agriculture organization, representing about 7,000 farm and ranch families. Our primary mission is to represent these families in the policy and legal arenas. OFB opposes 2853. As proposed, the bill would end tax credits available to a whole suite of agricultural producers seeking to dispose of byproducts in an environmentally sustainable manner. Specifically, the bill would end credits available to producers using grass, wheat, straw, and other vegetative biomass in the production of bioenergy and biofuel. In addition to those byproducts, the bill would end tax credits available to animal agriculturists who operate manure digesters if that digester came online after the first of this year. For background, digesters break down animal waste through an anaerobic process, essentially creates two valuable byproducts for the farmer. First is energy for on or off farm use. Second is actually digested fibers that they use for animal bedding. Benefits to public are threefold. Digesters have air quality benefits. They make it easier for farmers to manage water quality. And they contribute to our renewable energy portfolio. The program has been very successful, and I think you've heard today, for encouraging dairy farmers to invest in digesters. Since its inception, I believe at 8 or 9 locations now across the state, they're processing waste about 35% of all dairy cows in the state. And I think ending, as you probably heard this, credits will foreseeably change this kind of upward trend, which is going to result in unrealized environmental and economic benefits for both the farmer and the public at large. Lastly, I think this sunset would affect an industry segment which has been especially hard hit in recent years. Due to several factors outside of their control, grass and seed producers have had increasing difficulty disposing of their byproducts with restrictions on field burning in the valley, Port of Portland closures. It's hard for them to get rid of these products without taking a loss right now. Removing the incentives, I think, would foreclose any development. I know they haven't been claimed in the past, but it's an option for kind of innovation in the future. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. So thanks.
Okay. And Tammy.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Danny. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, located here in Salem. And we represent, have the proud opportunity of representing 228 grade A dairy farms here in the state of Oregon. They are multi-generational. They span the entire state from the coast to far eastern Oregon and down into southern Oregon. And those 228 dairy farms in 2015 generated about economic value of fluid milk, $474 million strong. That's pretty impressive for 228 dairy farms. That is not the monies that they retained, of course. All of those dollars go back into investing into their operations, and that was the value of the fluid milk that they produced, that they sent away from farm, that then was processed into the cheese, the yogurt, and other dairy products that we enjoy, including ice cream and others. So we have a lot to say about the importance of maintaining this sector of the agricultural industry here in the state of Oregon. We're really proud to stand strong and want to champion everything that is good, that is on dairy, and to speak in opposition to House Bill 2853. In the 2016 short session, we came alongside of Lynn Bernstein and Three Mile Canyon Farm to talk chiefly amongst in that sector about what would happen if we lost that the tax credit in the short session. And because of the give and take and the conversations that occurred during the short session, it was agreed to by all parties that that tax credit would be reduced and there would be a ramp down to 2021. That was just agreed to just over a year ago, and we support that that policy remain in place to allow for that ramping down to 2021 and moving forward from there. In the 2008 Dairy Air Task Force, there was a great deal of conversation about best management practices on farm and what would those look like. Our dairy specialists went to work and have done a great deal to inform the conversation for our producers, and attached to the testimony today is a matrix that has been widely distributed and referenced for the dairy producers in all of the different categories and sectors on farm, from their nutrition aspects to housing, bedding, grazing, manure storage, land applications, and so on. It's broken down into three simple sectors and matrixed tier one, tier two, and tier three. These are best management practices that are voluntary and in a voluntary adoption forum on farm for our producers, and they're taking these very seriously and aggressively to the very best of their ability in $15 milk prices, working to achieve this matrix and working themselves into a voluntary capacity across to tier three. The largest of our dairies are able to achieve tier three matrix very easily because they have capacity. Some of our smaller operations are still somewhere around tier one or between tier one and tier two, but it's still achieving the outcomes that were described and talked about and discussed very thoroughly during that Dairy Air Task Force conversation. So we're very proud of the progress that has been made in our industry. This tax credit is one of many tools that is available to the industry currently to take care of manure, and when not used as a nitrogen source, a nutrient for on-farm crops, but it's used then for production of energy. We're proud of the fact that our producers are taking every measure available to them and where they can, employing all best management practices, including finding ways and mechanisms to move themselves forward where they can. I learned as we prepared for this hearing today that one of our Tillamook producers, who does have an on-farm digester, they are required to sign over their tax credit to the company that then they built, that built this structure on farm for them. So to remove that policy and to create some kind of wrinkle or unintended consequence, we certainly want to be certain that we know what we're doing as we're having the conversation, and that we're not creating some unintended consequence for existing policyholders, existing agreements that are in place between farmers and between these companies that have established these facilities. There have been some hiccups and starts and stops as these facilities facilities have been sited or intended to be sited on farm. That's created some challenges, but that's the startup phase of any new kind of program. So there are opportunities for us to continue to grow and to continue to learn. We want to be sure that we are maintaining our very best good stewardship going forward, taking care of the environment, taking care of our herds and our families, and being good partners in our communities. We're asking that you, and urging that you please, with all due respect, oppose House Bill 2853 as it is written. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any brief questions for these folks? Representative Brock-Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tammy, and thank you for your testimony. So to go back to the environmental piece of this, these manure digesters are, of course, recycling the manure and using them in two ways, as you mentioned. One, to create energy. Two, to utilize as a fertilizer in the place of nitrogen-based fertilizers. Would you say that was best practice in limiting the amount of nitrogen-based fertilizers that cause runoff and so forth and can exacerbate issues in our streams and rivers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brock-Smith, absolutely. Our producers, when they are able to co-locate their dairy operation with field crops and then utilize that nutrient source to provide the necessary nutrition for their crops, that is done under a very heavy regulation that is monitored by the Department of Agriculture. So that manages, and they are under that auspices for limiting and preventing any types of runoff that might occur in that crop. There are soil samples that are taken with regularity and regulators that visit the farm frequently to ensure compliance.
Brief follow-up. Thank you. I guess the core of my question is, what is it more environmentally sound to use the recycled manure than nitrogen-based fertilizers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brock-Smith, commercially speaking, there would probably be some difference of opinion, of course, from those companies that produce those fertilized products that are not nutrient-based from on-farm. So I certainly would not want to get into that kind of debate. But for the producer, they're always looking at their bottom line. They're attempting to really do everything that they can to minimize their input costs. So it is a closed-loop system. It fulfills their need for a nutrient product without having to go to the commercial market.
Okay, thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Ivan, can you join us? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, I am Ivan Molesky, the policy director with Friends of Family Farmers. We appreciate you bringing this bill forward for a discussion today, and we appreciate Representative Barnhart's explanation of the context for why it's worth considering at this time. What I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today is why we believe this is a good opportunity to restructure how we look at this tax credit, particularly to find ways to benefit small and mid-sized dairy farmers. So Friends of Family Farmers, the organization I work for, represents small and mid-sized farmers and ranchers across Oregon, and we're testifying here in support of House Bill 2853 today. We have a number of significant concerns about the current structure of Oregon's manure digester tax credit program. Like other biomass tax credits, it was originally set to sunset at the end of 2017, but unlike other biomass tax credits, it was extended until the end of 2021 last year. It is now the state's costliest biomass tax credit, administered by the troubled Oregon Department of Energy, which has now begun advocating for its sunset. This tax credit has no system in place outside of the legislature to independently verify its alleged benefits to the state of Oregon in relation to its financial costs. Given Oregon's current budget situation and the potential for this program to experience continued rising costs if new digesters come online over the next few years, we believe the legislature should be returning the sunset to its originally intended date at the end of 2017 this session and allow this tax credit to expire at that time. While this bill does not do that, it would limit taxpayer expenditures to only those digesters currently in operation, while bigger questions about the need to restructure the program are addressed. Though the tax credit was established in 2007, taxpayer expenditures jumped dramatically with the addition of a single digester to accommodate manure from roughly one-third of the cows of Oregon's largest dairy concentrated animal feeding operation in 2013. In the 2015 tax year, this credit cost taxpayers over $4 million. This prompted a reduction in the per ton payments last year, but the tax credit is still on track to cost taxpayers roughly $5 million in the current biennium without any additional digesters added. In our view, tax credits for new digesters should not be considered until the state adopts the Oregon Dairy Air Emissions Program as outlined by the state's Task Force on Dairy Air Quality from 2008. Despite a longstanding consensus around the need for such an air quality program, Oregon does not monitor independently or track methane or other air emissions from livestock operations, including those that have taken advantage of this tax credit. While manure digesters are intended to capture methane from manure and convert it to electricity, they produce only a tiny fraction of Oregon's renewable energy portfolio, and their usefulness as a methane reduction strategy is limited. Manure digesters, for example, do not address methane produced during the rumination process of livestock like dairy cows, the methane that cows exhale. The EPA, for example, has estimated that these are the vast majority of methane emissions from dairy cows, not manure. And manure digesters do not typically address air emissions, other air contaminant emissions associated with large dairy operations. If Oregon's goal with this tax credit is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or lead to cleaner air, we believe that incentives for grazing dairy cows on pasture would be a far more effective way to reduce overall emissions and increase carbon sequestration in soils than incentivizing manure digesters in facilities where livestock do not have access to pasture. Such a shift would actually support small and mid-sized family farmers. If Oregon's goal for this tax credit is to support struggling small and mid-sized dairy farms, it has failed. In 2007, when this tax credit began, Oregon had nearly 600 dairy farms in operation, a number that has dropped to fewer than 240 in the decade since this tax credit has been in effect. Since manure digesters need a steady supply of manure for year-round operation, the tax credit currently tends to encourage confinement livestock management systems rather than those which prioritize having animals outdoors on pasture, practices which have multiple environmental and animal health benefits. In fact, Oregon dairy farmers are some of Oregon's best environmental stewards. We've got a number of Oregon farmers here raising cows on pasture, producing the highest quality products. So I want to make sure it's clear that we do not oppose those operations. What we're talking about here is how we structure these incentives and what sorts of livestock operation they promote. The primary beneficiary of the manure digester tax credit to date and looking forward is Oregon's largest dairy CAFO, Three Mile Canyon Farms, whose lobbyist has testified here today. Further, a recently proposed 30,000-head dairy near Boardman builds a digester as proposed in its animal waste management plan. It will add unknown additional costs for Oregon taxpayers. So we respectfully ask you to support this bill with a do-pass recommendation to help control the cost of this program while larger policy considerations around air emissions from large dairy operations are considered. We believe there are a number of steps are warranted to better address the underlying policy questions around air, methane and air contaminant emissions from large livestock operations. These include, number one, before offering new tax credit for animal manure digesters, the Environmental Quality Commission should establish an air quality program as proposed by Oregon's Dairy Air Quality Task Force in 2008. A variety of cost-effective best management practices should be developed and implemented over time. They could include some of what we're talking about today, but they should include other items as well. Senate Bill 197, currently before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, would require the establishment of this program by 2019. Number two, as Representative Barnhart mentioned, we support the position that new, large, confined, or concentrated animal feeding operations in Oregon, likely to have significant methane or other air emissions, should be required to construct and operate animal manure digesters, not offered tax credits to do so. While this bill does not go this far in its current form, it would ensure that tax credits are not available for new digesters coming into operation after January 1st. And then lastly, tax credits offered in the future should be designed to primarily help small and mid-sized farms adopt the technology, particularly in regions where multiple benefits related to air and water quality can be quantified. Additionally, if considering animal manure-related tax credits at all, incentives to encourage producers to get cows outdoors and on pasture more of the year, and incentivizing practices like rotational grazing and soil carbon sequestration should be part of the program, not solely tax credits for digesters, as is the current approach. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Ivan? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ivan, I share your concern about runaway tax credits. To that end, it's my understanding that the reason that the tax credit was reduced to try and rein in and corral those costs. the ag industry agreed to a reduction that in no way benefited them in terms of percentage of tax incentive, but they did so presumably on the basis of certainty out into the future of how long that tax credit would last. And, you know, as a state, we need to be able to go to certain sectors of our economy and ask them for help. The ag industry came and helped us here try and corral those costs. They're representative of a quarter of our state's economy, direct and indirect. Out into the future, we're going to need to undoubtedly at some point come back to the ag industry and ask them for other sources of help. If we break the trust now, what incentive is there for this major sector of our state's economy to want to deal with the state of Oregon out into the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, to be clear, this bill does not affect the agriculture industry as a whole, as you know. It just affects those facilities with operating methane digesters and those that would be proposed in the near future. So, but I would simply answer that when this program was first created, it included various sunset dates, and the most recent sunset date up until last year was at the end of this year. Anyone who had built a digester over the previous decade was aware, up until last year, was aware of its sunset date. So the decision to reduce it was precipitated perhaps by the reality that was sunsetting, and so the trade-off was that the sunset was extended for this particular credit. That said, there are no cost controls in the current, other than the per ton reduction in the credit, there are no cost controls. So for example, if we see new manure digesters established at this time, for example, within the next year, as has been proposed at this, what would be Oregon's second largest dairy, we will have a new burden on this particular credit. It expires at the end of 2021. And so we're going to have that discussion at some point anyway on whether these are indefinite tax credits or whether they expire when we talk about having them expire.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, follow up.
And I agree with you. And I think that 2021 is the time in which we all agreed to have that discussion. And in terms of political perception, I think there will be many in the agricultural community, whether they're dairymen or not. You know, if you take one of us on, you take all of us on, and or if you break faith with my brothers and sisters over here, I can't trust you either. Anyways,
Mr. Chair, if I could simply respond, we're part of that industry too, Mr. Witt, and we agreed, Representative Witt, we agreed a decade ago to the recommendations of the consensus recommendations of the Dairy Quality Task Force. The reality is they have never been implemented. These tax credits were always under discussion in the context of a larger program in which we do not have in place. And so our view is that we've got a lot of work to do to establish the overarching program to address these issues. And as our testimony indicated, let's target these to support a larger share of Oregon's farmers, not just potentially the largest operations, as has been how this money is spent to date.
When it comes to tax credits and the discussion on the public policy, be careful of what you wish for.
Vice Chair McLean.
I appreciated your comments on the fact that we have to have a variety of tools in the toolbox to be able to take care of air and water quality as it relates to agricultural pursuits or agricultural crops and or livestock types of scenarios. But my basic question is, I've lived on a dairy farm for 7 or 8 years, and my understanding is that you are supporting this type of facility, this type of bio degeneration, this use of this material, and that you do think it's a good process.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, correct. Okay. We agreed back in 2008 under the Oregon Dairy Air Quality Task Force, which we served on, that manure tax credits, digester tax credits could be part of a broader program that included a variety of both voluntary and regulatory approaches. In fact, what you see happening in Tillamook County is a good example of where if you have a strategic investment that helps a number of smaller and mid-sized dairies participate in these, you can have both water quality and air quality benefits as well as economic benefits. Where we have concerns are where these, because of some of the lack of sideboards on this tax credit, we're seeing primary beneficiaries in terms of the economic cost to taxpayers be a single operation, which is Oregon's largest confinement operation. And because there are not caps in place, we have the ability to see, potential to see more significant operations coming online that would take advantage of this use of taxpayer dollars. So to us, it's about strategic use of these in key regions to help small and mid-sized farmers as part of a larger set of tools. Again, we think there are a lot of values in actually the more you can get cows on pasture, the better environmental benefits you're going to see, and this that could be part of the discussion as well.
And I like happy cows too, and I like to see cows on pasture. I mean, that's on the side for me. But what you just said, I mean, you're looking for a program that has more than one tool, and you're looking for a program that can help mid or small size farms as well as the large, and I do see sideboards. I see a $3.50 per wet. Ton or whatever it was, wet cubicle ton, but it also gives a deadline of 2021 to have the rest of this conversation. So I wanted to make it clear on the record that you were agreeing that this is definitely part of a good package of tools.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, we agree it's part of a good package of tools. I want to clarify, however, that we believe that a more strategic policy approach would be to, for the very largest operations, that this should be sort of a part of the cost of doing business as a requirement to include these kinds of air quality controls, not necessarily something that is
that's
provided
really glad.
Tax
I'm
credits.
Glad you brought
or,
that back.
Tax credits are
I'm glad
are
you brought
for.
That back up, and I make this my last one, and that is the fact that we're talking about regulation versus incentives, so carrot versus stick, but you also realize that not every farm is going to have one of these digesters, that there's going to be 7, 9, 10, 12, whatever it takes across the state to be able to do that job. So not every farm is going to need a digester, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Further questions? Okay, I will say that this session is a difficult one because we've been asked as a committee to hold back our financial asks such as farm to school until we find offsets ourselves in our own committees or eventually send to Ways and Means once we finally get released. So all the desirable programs out there in my mind are currently right now being set up against farm to school for money. And so I'm always excited to get suggestions on how to save money like CAPIT. And I do think there's a relevant question here about new entities versus people who've already been made commitments to, and send a clear message to people who aren't currently in Oregon, who currently aren't even using the program, about the long-term expectation of receiving this benefit. And it sounds like right now they've got it till 2021, but I don't know that we want to set up an expectation that it's going to continue after that, which I think right now the more people you bring in, the likelier it is that you're going to end up extending it in 2021 as well. So I don't know where we go from here on this bill, but I think the conversation was a good one to have had today regardless. And I've got nobody else here on this bill. Bill, unless you – I didn't get you on the sign-up sheet, and I've got to get Representative Witt in here in a bill. Is this a – did we miss you earlier? Did you just show up after we got talking about this and get excited? Okay, come on up. Erin's going to get bumped again, I think, on her annexation rebuttals.
I'll make this quick, Chair.
All right.
For the record, Bill Quitting, Partners Industrial Council. Our organization is neutral on this bill, but if I may fill you in on what's happened to Woody Biomass. That's our backbone.
Bill, this is really a different topic, and we've got three bills waiting to go. So can we have you back another time to talk about Woody Biomass if it's not about manure? because this bill's not even related in any way to woody biomass. I've got people waiting to talk on
if
the
I may
topic.
Just say, sir, we've lost our tax credit for woody biomass completely. Thank you.
Yeah.
I will be back.
Okay. It's a worthwhile topic. I just want to get. Okay, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2853. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2566. Ask Representative Witt. Al, do you want to come up? Do you want to do from the.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that gesture. Given the time factor here, I know that our friends in the hunting community can adequately address this, and I'd hope that the committee focuses attention on the amended version. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. I'll tell it, and don't know our other guests here.
Paul Don Hefner.
What is it?
Paul Don Hefner.
Don Hefner. Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Clam, Representative Witt, thank you for the introduction. For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. I'm, as the chair has said, we're looking at the Dash 1 amendments, page 2, line 3 of that amendment. What this basically does is opens up the youth mentor program from the age of 14, the current cap, to the age of 17. In their testimony on their budget in the year 2015, ODFW said that range program included close to 20,000 participants, maybe a little bit over. What we would like to do with this amendment is respond to surveys that we have seen from youth who would like to hunt but don't have the time but would like to have the opportunity, and this would give them both the time and the opportunity to do so. So we are excited about this bill, and we think it will be a success to encourage more youth to participate in recreational hunting. We would be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
And, sir?
I'm Paul Don Hefner. I'm the legislative chair of the Oregon Hunters Association, and I'm just here to answer any questions, support the bill with the amendments. We think it makes a lot of sense to expand this to the age of 17 and give those youth 14 to 17 the opportunity to be mentored in this program.
Okay. Any questions for these two gentlemen? And this is the amendment you've just described.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then I've got, I believe it's Chris Friend. Please come on up. Please.
Hi, my name is Chris Friend. I'm the president of the Oregon Hunter Education Instructors Association. Our concern with the amendment to the bill is that it would create a loophole where youth would not have to take hunter education courses. If they start at 9 and go to 17, they go from 17 to 18 straight out into the hunting community without any hunter education course.
Good call.
Because right now, tell us how the current system works.
Current system is 9 to 13. Then when they become 14, they would have to do their hunter education course in order to participate in hunting. Under the Mentored Youth Program, you're not required to have hunter education because you're working with somebody else, usually a parent, grandparent, another adult, that's guiding you through the process, teaching you what they know. But if the program is extended to 17, they go through that whole process, never getting any formal training from anybody outside that circle.
So the amendment does have a requirement that they have in their possession a certificate issued by ODF&W or an agency or another state's equivalent of ODF&W, saying that they've satisfactorily completed the a course in the safe handling of lawful hunting, which I think we think of as hunter safety.
Right, but under the Mentored Youth Program, you're not required to have that hunter education certification. It's a training program, intended for youth to be able to get out there earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So if they go to 17, then they go 18, and then we're not required to have it from 18 and up. There's no requirement for adults to have hunter education in the state.
Yeah, right. But am I missing something? But the bill, even the bill does require that the person under 18. So you're saying the person is. It's got an or. Or is provided. I got it. So it's you either have a hunter safety or you are in the Mentor Youth Program.
Correct.
And that's what you're worried about.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Any questions for Chris?
I'd like to follow up on that.
McKeown.
I think it's important to follow up on that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, because I certainly was forced to take one, and it was a good thing I did.
Yeah.
It was a positive.
Yeah, it's a matter of ethics. It's a matter of safety. There's a lot of things that kids pick up from outside sources that they learn more from.
Yeah, I mean, generally you like to think that the person taking hunting for the first time does it, but not always, I'm sure. I mean, my dad certainly gave me equivalent scoldings about not watching where I was pointing my gun, et cetera, that I got in hunter safety. But I'm sure there are people who don't know all of the things you teach in the classes.
Generally, our experience is once we start a class, all the adults that come after we take our first break come up to us and say, wow, this is really different than when I took
something.
It. Can we sign up still?
Yeah, interesting. Okay. All right, thank you for your feedback on that, and we will talk a little bit more about that offline. And so I'm going to close. Anybody else here on this? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 2566. And, let's talk about this work session here. Committee members, remember we had a discussion about the unexpended monies in the Hatchery Research Center, and there was really strong concern that we weren't supplanting the research or the upgrades to implement the research technology findings with just normal basic construction that would otherwise potentially happen. Like, you need to repair the roof. Don't use the research money to repair the roof. So Representative McKeown, I think, worked on this amendment. Do you want to tell us about it?
Actually,
let me look at it. Yeah, could have Misty tell us about it.
Yeah, Misty, can you give us the update on the amendment? Does it solve our problem?
Sure. Chair Klim, Representative McKeown, and the rest of the committee, the Dash 1 amendments would specify that the money from Hatchery Construction Fund would only be used to do those kinds of activities that improve, upgrade, or replace current coastal hatchery facilities in the effort to incorporate new technologies. So I believe that the conversation was about new roofs, and that would preclude this particular fund from being used in that manner.
For general maintenance.
Right.
It has to have some nexus with the research that's being done by the Hatchery Research Center.
Okay, and those are the Dash ones, which I can't seem to find, but they're probably online in OLIS. So is there any folks have remaining issues on this besides how those funds were used? Okay, well, then let me go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2266.
Yes. There's also rescinded sub-referral.
Oh.
So
Missy's just noting this bill doesn't have to go to Ways and Means at this point. So
does it or does not?
Does not. Does not. Because we're not appropriating any money. We're just kind of changing the parameters around the use of the money.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2266 as amended to the floor. Mr. Klim, Chair Klim, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/13/17.
Vice Chairman McLean moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/13/17. Any discussion? These are the ones that place the sideboards on the not allowing more routine maintenance to be funded with this. Any objection to these amendments? Okay. Seeing none, so adopted.
So now, Chair Klim, I move House Bill 2266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it's referred on to the Committee of Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the subsequent referral to the Committee on the Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Okay. No further discussion? Any objection? Okay. If none, the motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor. Representative Brock Smith will carry this one. And Aaron, do you want to come do one of them? Like the island one is pretty short for you to oppose that one, I assume.
I can wait till.
Okay, we'll let the committee off the hook and get your 8 minutes back. Thank you for your patience, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Oh, wait.
Let me carry over the public hearings on House Bills 2039 and 2040. Mm-hmm. And adjourn the committee.
Thank you.
Committee.
Thank you.
40. Mm-hmm. And adjourn the